Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to welcome here tonight Governor Amino Fraga, the governor of the Central Bank of Brazil. Governor Fraga was appointed to his position in March 1999, shortly after the Brazilian currency was floated. As you know, Brazil has had a remarkable economic success in the intervening year and a half since that occurred, rebounding as strongly or more strongly than as any of the Asian countries. Governor Fraga has had a long career, an academic economics career, starting with a PhD at Princeton, continuing with a period as deputy governor of the Central Bank in the early 1990s, and having worked as managing director for Soros for some 6 years before taking over as governor of the Central Bank of Brazil. I should add, in case I should forget otherwise, that Arminio and I are both friends of Rosa Lastra. It was really Rosa who was responsible inviting Arminio here. I say that in part because Rosa can't be here tonight. She just had her third baby boy at the end of last week. I thought I would just I wanted to add that before Governor Fraga addresses us on monetary and financial regime changes in Brazil.
Governor.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles. I don't know what the practice is to stand or to sit.
Whichever you like. It's a liberal free institution.
All right, I probably don't need a microphone. But if you can't hear me, let me know. I'll sit here and use the microphone. Why not? Let me try to give you a roadmap of what I would like to go over here this afternoon. I'll start by thanking Charles and Rosa for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to move away from the day-to-day rhythm of life down in Brasilia, and to be given a chance really to reflect on the longer term and on the deeper changes that are taking place in Brazil, and also more importantly on those that we would like to try to develop going forward. The topic that I have chosen, I won't take too much time. I'm trying to try to calibrate this so that we can do it over 20 minutes. One thing going on your side here is that I had some problems with my notes, my luggage, and therefore I may omit some points unless they get here in time. So then we can make up for that by doing what I think is perhaps even more important than speaking, which is listening, and maybe you can guide me through whatever is it is that you're interested in. But anyway, we have been doing some work in Brazil trying to understand the, in many ways, the reasons for the difficult period that started for us in the early 80s and it took us through the mid-90s, and what it is that we can do to fix what was wrong and to put us back on a solid development path. And if one looks back at those terrible years, one finds a few obvious factors at work. One was tremendous macroeconomic instability. We had during those years bouts of high and hyperinflation, followed by plans that in most cases were short-lived to fight it. We had balance of payments troubles, debt moratoria, you name it. And we also had during this whole phase tremendous instability in the rules of the game. And the rules in particular, as as I'm focusing here on monetary and financial issues, on the rules that dictate the operation of monetary and financial things in Brazil. As a consequence of that, if one looks, and we're doing some preliminary analysis of, say, productivity trends during this era, what we find is not surprising, but nevertheless somewhat shocking. If you take the 80s, preliminary estimates of total factor productivity show negative TFP changes to the tune of 1% a year. So we had negative 1% per year average total factor productivity change in Brazil, which is astounding, and it's something that obviously needs to change. As we get into the 90s, the numbers seem to show a turnaround. Maybe the opening of the economy did something. Certainly the stabilization starting in 94 did a lot to it. And in the 90s, we find probably something getting that gets us closer to 1% of GDP positive TFP change. And I use total factor productivity as opposed to, say, these measures of industrial productivity, which are typically show much higher numbers, which typically also are flawed and biased by things like outsourcing and so on. What we seem to see is quite positive, but we need to go deeper, and we need to think about exactly where things are and what we can do. Also, along the lines of kind of looking at the big picture, the ratio of loans to GDP in Brazil is very low. It's around a third. So we have in Brazil, even now, after five, six years of low inflation, what is clearly a state of atrophy in the financial sector. That's also true of the capital markets at large, even though we do have a well-functioning stock market and a well-functioning government debt market. I would say it is clearly insufficient for the development rhythm that we would like to see in the economy. Studies done here recently by the World Bank, also preliminary, seem to indicate, doing cross-country work, cross-section, cross-country analysis, that improving the financial sector alone would give Brazil an extra 1%, one percentage point of GDP in growth. Not forever, obviously, but for quite a while. So there's enough there to make us think, and there's clearly a tremendous upside if we get things right. And with that in mind, I would like to then talk about the things that we're trying to do. They basically focus on the two weaknesses that I mentioned. On the one hand, this tremendous macroeconomic instability that had and still has to be dealt with. Less now than in the past, fortunately, but something we can't relax about, number one. And then a tremendous situation of financial atrophy, of financial inefficiency, which again is also quite costly. Now the strategy then is one of addressing these problems directly. On the macro side, we started out, and I'm not going to tell you the history of Brazil from 1500. Let me take as a starting point the moment of the floating of our exchange rate. We started out at that point from a position of very low inflation, but a position which displayed, as was discussed at the time, weakness on the fiscal side, as so frequently is the case, and a changing monetary environment, whereby Brazil left a system where the exchange rate was, say, the nominal anchor, and moved into a floating exchange rate system, and therefore requiring a change in anchor. We, as most of you know, or many of you know, I would assume, decided then to move to a full-fledged inflation targeting system, very much along the lines adopted here in the UK. The system was played a dual role for us. It had first and foremost at that point, and now you have to go back and imagine what the situation was with the exchange rate jumping from 120 to 10 and acting in very nervous fashion for many weeks. And our first goal was to make sure we stabilized things, and with our history of inflation, we wanted to make sure that we didn't go back to the old unstable environment. So inflation targeting played a key role in anchoring expectations and also pointing us in the right direction, but also with the idea of establishing a more permanent anchor for things nominal in the economy, again, in very standard fashion here. The system we adopted perforce was one that required something that I believe we all acknowledge now is important in the conduct of monetary policies, which is a very, very high degree of transparency. So we felt at that stage that transparency is something that comes with accuracy and some degree of precision. We felt that it was important that we didn't waste a chance to jump into a new system that we felt was right for the country, but in very turbulent times. What we did was perhaps something different than most countries that adopted inflation targeting. This is we went into inflation targeting in as sort of a two-step sequence. The first was during the worst moments of the crisis to announce that we would be targeting inflation. This was March 1999. It feels like decades ago right now. But we first announced that we would adopt inflation targeting. And we said at the same time that we would announce the targets at the end of June. So we gave ourselves a four-month window. That was the height of the crisis. We engaged in a program with the IMF, obtained financial support that helped stabilize things. And we announced also at that point that we expected that by the end of the year, inflation would be running at a one-digit annualized rate. That was as far as we got at that point. We tightened monetary policy, tightened fiscal policy, and managed it on a day-to-day basis. At the end of June, we then launched the formal inflation targeting system. By then, with all the bells and whistles, the work was done in record short time by a newly created research department at the central bank. The gentleman who did that work, one of the deputy governors, I believe, has had the occasion to visit here. And I'm not sure he made a presentation, but we started a research department, which we didn't have. We had a very good economics department, but not a formal research department. And we actually started sort of on a provisional internal basis running an inflation targeting system right away with all the uncertainty that comes with it. If you're an economist, you can't imagine the difficulty in estimating any sort of reliable model or relationship when so many things are changing. In particular, there was a question of exchange rate pass-through, which we knew very little about because we had just come from a long period of fixed or managed exchange rates, and quite a bit more. So it took some hard work during those 4 months to at least put us in a position where we felt we were ready to go. But when the time came, things were already looking better. We then picked a target for the remaining 6 months of the year, which was then 8%. And the target for this year was 6%. We're on our way to meeting that target despite the supply shock environment we are experiencing now. Target for next year is 4%, and we now have picked, as we do on a rolling basis, the target for the next year. So we have 2001. We picked the target for 2002. That's 3.5%. We did not then have a core index in Brazil, so we chose a headline index as our goal, with a slightly wider band than one usually sees. The issue of bandwidth is an interesting one and a difficult one. We picked 2 percentage points and have been living with it. Thank you, Charles. Since then, inadequate fashion, but that was an issue we dealt with early on, again, with some risk. The first inflation report was published at the end of June, right as we announced that target. And as I said, this year we picked the target for 2002, which is the 3.5%. Next year we will be picking a target that will move us into the next administration. We find that to be an important part of this, which is a certain sense of discipline that the system brings. We do it for, again, I'm talking to an audience of economists, we believe that we have to run away from the sort of intertemporal temptations or inconsistencies that we find so frequently in history. I may have more to say if I get my notes, but anyway, that's sort of the general launching. Issued the system was created by a presidential decree, which gives us some autonomy, and it shows a high level commitment. We don't have a law granting the central bank board and president a fixed term mandate like you have in many countries. It's a topic of debate in Brazil these days, but we have in practice been given a target. The target was picked, this is important, by the government and was given to us. And of course, the other side of the coin is we were given the autonomy to pursue those targets. So it was a very balanced approach, which you also see here and in New Zealand, I think, pioneered this quite effectively. It tends to commit the government in a more effective way. And I also find it in a democratic society that it makes sense to have this sort of division of power. And we're quite happy with that arrangement. Now, hand in hand with a change in the monetary regime comes the change in the exchange rate regime. They're one and the same. You only have one degree of freedom. And also the change in the fiscal regime. In the exchange rate regime, we had in Brazil with high inflation a tradition of managed exchange rates with capital controls, and a tendency to have a crawling exchange rate, which tends to be quite common in high inflation environments. You found that in Israel and Chile and in a few other countries. And once we floated, we had to make a decision as which way we wanted to go. And having lived through decades of capital controls and this sort of experience in Brazil, we were convinced at that point, and given also the economic structure of Brazil, if you think in terms of, again, very standard Mundell, McKinnon, Cannon, optimum currency area analysis, that Brazil is not a natural country to adopt some other currency as its own, that in Brazil it made sense for us to pursue the development of our own monetary standard. We chose it to be that way, and it is clear and theoretically obvious that once you decide to go with inflation targeting, you must float, and indeed that's what we ended up doing. I feel strongly, having studied this for many years, having lived through it as a market participant and having lived through it as a government official before in Brazil, that the intermediate regimes are prone to trouble. I am skeptical of the so-called intermediate or managed exchange rate regimes. One, because they tend to lead to confusion, and by that I mean private actors, agents, society at large, I should say, tends to get confused in establishing risk patterns. They, as a result, tend to structure balance sheets with perhaps more risk than one would desire. For instance, if you have a floating exchange rate and you are in a non-traded goods industry, well, you typically wouldn't want to borrow in foreign currency if your exchange rate is clearly floating. So the signaling element is very important. So you want to avoid confusion. The other thing you want to avoid is temptation, and the managed exchange rates have been prone to attacks of temptation by governments, which again frequently are prone to a myopic behavior. So that's a little detour on exchange rates, but we adopted a floating exchange rate and have been gradually liberalizing our capital account. This process actually started 10 years ago in Brazil, and I'd say we're quite close to a system of substantial freedom. I will get to the banking discussion in a moment. I'm taking up a lot of time, but my feeling is one can do this safely, particularly when you have, of course, a strong monetary regime in place on the other side, and you have a strong financial regime, which is what I'm moving to in a second. There are my notes. Thank you. Now, the other point I wanted to mention is the so-called, it's not that much written. The other point, let me see if I left much out, but the other point that I wanted to mention is the fiscal regime. It's very important. I don't want to spend a long time here. I could probably go on for hours telling you what happened in Brazil, particularly because I feel, even though this isn't the topic of our discussion here today, I feel that without a proper, strong fiscal regime in place, it is impossible to establish a proper monetary standard on the other side. One needs the other, actually, because without a proper, stable price environment, a budget really doesn't mean much. And I can tell you that from our experience in Brazil. A budget needs a certain degree of transparency to be meaningful. So these things kind of go hand in hand, and we were in this vicious circle in Brazil with fiscal and monetary and balance of payments problems, which we are now, I think, breaking away from. On the fiscal side, there's a lot to be said, starting with the state finance situation, which has been addressed in Brazil with many important actions on the part of government, including taming the terrible state bank epidemia that we had in Brazil. The state banks were acting like independent monetary authorities, not committed to a stable environment. In effect, some sort of a, Pedro Malan used to call them, some sort of an immature monetary union, where each bank had the right to print and no incentive, in fact, not to watch after the public good. That has been dealt with. Our Social Security system has been the subject of two important rounds of reform. And last but not least, we have something now called the Fiscal Responsibility Law, which is an absolute beauty. It's a very strong budget law with everything you want to have in such a law. So right now, what we're looking at in Brazil, and I won't dwell on this too much, is really something where we're jump-starting the two regimes in parallel, and they have to kind of move simultaneously to work. But let me just concentrate on the monetary and financial side. Now, on the financial side, there's one link, or many links, but there's one good link to move us from the macro, which I believe I've mostly covered from what I see here in my notes. So there's one thing I must say before I move on to the micro, just to wake you up a little bit, which is the following thing. I had been a deputy governor of the Central Bank of Brazil in the early 90s, and those were very difficult times. And I won't go back to that. The memories are not very much fun for me. But the one thing I remember very clearly is there was such confusion in the air that it was extremely hard for us to step away from the day-to-day life of a regulator, of a crisis fireman type feeling, and to take the careful, cautious, unemotional view that one must take when deciding on monetary policy. It was usually the last item on a meeting that would last for 7 hours. By the time we got there, there wasn't enough coffee in Brazil to keep us alert and to get us to review all the data. And not that we were making mistakes. The situation was so tough that most decisions were almost obvious by default. It was such an emergency climate. But at any rate, what we have now is a major change, which is the creation of a monetary policy committee, which meets over 2 days. And the fact that it meets over 2 days really means you start meeting 2 weeks before, reviewing the data and forecasts and the anecdotal evidence and the models and all of that. And the Monetary Policy Committee has become, for us, you may take this for granted here in the UK, but it became a ritual for us, which I find to be extremely important. The fact that we can move out of the day-to-day life of working on this or that or the other, and to focus on what is our most important task, after all, in a central bank. So that's sort of, I call that the ritual change in our country. But anyway, I was moving along towards a link with the micro. And the link is indeed very important, because everything we do with interest rates, which are our instrument, impacts the economy through what we typically call a transmission mechanism. And with underdeveloped financial markets, the transmission mechanism can be weak and can be a problem. So we were interested in fixing that quickly, not only for microeconomic reasons, but also because we felt we needed a more powerful transmission mechanism. In many ways, one could argue, and this might be a bit of a stretch, but I'll say it anyway, that the incredible interest rate volatility you had in Brazil was not only due to fixed or managed exchange rates, but also to a weak transmission mechanism, where you really weren't very effective for a variety of reasons. Now, on the financial side of things, we have gone about things really looking at it from two angles. On the one hand, there's an element of prudence, and I use that word in a sort of a technical way, if I can. I mean here prudential, forward-looking, systemic protection of the system. And here we went about quite a few important projects. One was a change in the provisioning rules, which have become very forward-looking, and we're quite happy with that, and we're working on fine-tuning it, provisioning for credit losses, of course. There were important changes on the consolidation rules. We in Brazil have financial conglomerates. So for us, as the supervisor, it is key. And by the way, we supervise the system in Brazil, unlike what you have. Well, it's a blended system here and in many countries. In Brazil, it's still inside the central bank. It was difficult to do so with weak consolidation rules for financial institutions. So we went through some quite important changes. We now feel we have good quality data coming to us, not only because of the provisioning rules, but also because of the changes in consolidation. And consolidation includes offshore, includes also the relationship between the banks or the financial intermediaries and funds they manage. It includes non-financial subsidiaries where they are relevant, and so on. And we're also going through a major reform in our payment system, which is quite adequate as it is now, but which we feel needs to move on to 21st century standards. We're moving along very, very well on that path as well. Now, with the prudential side came deregulation and liberalization. One feels they have to come hand in hand. On the deregulation side, we have been lowering reserve requirements. We have been lifting all kinds of directed credit guidelines, and we've done quite a bit on kind of the micro structure of banking in Brazil, making it more efficient, less expensive, with the ultimate goal of reducing the cost of capital in Brazil and making for a more efficient financial sector. The legal framework has been another area where we've spent a lot of time working on. I don't have formal research on this, but it is my impression that 80% or more of credit in Brazil is unsecured in practice. So it is then pretty straightforward to conclude that 80% of the credit is, or a large percentage of it is very inefficient. As you know, if you've studied any other country, I'm sure here in the UK, the way business works requires the ability to pledge, to collateralize, and that lowers the cost of doing business in Brazil. That isn't the case. I believe here or in the U.S. it's probably the reverse. It's 10 or 20% unsecured. The rest we have some form of collateral. And that's something we're working on in Brazil. For instance, in mortgages, there's been an important legal change that will allow the mortgage markets to function in Brazil, and is a crucial element of a development strategy, if you will. So a lot going on the legal framework. Next to financial regulations and banking regulations, I can say a few words before I stop on capital markets. The capital markets in this free environment that we have in Brazil play a key role, and you can't look at banking without looking at capital markets for fear of missing the boat. There's quite a bit going on there as well. We're working on a new corporation law. Is moving through Congress quite well. It's been subject of a lot of debate and fine-tuning. The new law works on protecting minority shareholders, which has been a problem in Brazil. Will allow us to introduce better accounting standards. Will reinforce our Securities and Exchange Commission in Brazil, and I find that to be a big, big plus. And the other area we're working on that I find is also key, and if you look back at the history of the recent wave of crisis we've seen in international markets, say, of the last 6 years, you will know what I mean. The next topic is corporate governance. I believe it's not enough to get the banking thing right. One needs to watch also that side. And we're working on that in multiple fronts. I could go on for a long time on that, but the stock exchange in São Paulo is starting a Neuer market like the one in Germany, which is a self-selection mechanism for good governance companies. There's now a new change incoming in the way the National Development Bank is going to do business. The president of the National Development Bank has announced that. It's a long-term credit bank, whereby corporate governance will play a role in the criteria they use to select their lending, their borrowers. The pension system is moving in the direction of better governance and so on. So there's quite a bit there. And anyway, just to conclude, I've gone over the time I wanted to take. The feeling we have is this is the beginning of a virtuous circle. I won't give you the non-academic pitch here. It's not the purpose of this talk to sell you on Brazil. But what I find is, if you look back, we're quite an interesting case of a country moving away from a vicious circle of hyperinflation, inefficient financial markets, inefficient capital markets, weak fiscal institutions, trying to break away from that and moving over to stable macroeconomic conditions and efficient financial markets and capital markets. So I will stop here. I hope I haven't given you too much in a short period of time. I wanted to put a lot in there. There will be some questions or some topics you want to talk about. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now it is time for questions. And while you're all thinking of your questions, could I ask you on the point about collateralized lending? Is your bankruptcy law sufficiently strong? And one of the issues of the use of collateral is whether the banks actually can take on ownership without legal difficulties afterwards.
The short answer is no. You have to also keep in mind our legal system has different roots also, and that is very meaningful when it comes to this, not the Anglo-Saxon system of Roman approach. The bankruptcy law and the credit instruments that we have, for the most part, there's some new ones that we're hoping will move us out of this, can be improved. They make for a slow, in many instances, they lead to a long time for the, for lack of a better word, characterization of a loan, which can be a problem. How much exactly is owed, particularly or in the past when we had high inflation, that was a huge problem. How much is owed, what is the interest or the extent of arrears accumulating and so on, which has been subject to tremendous litigation in Brazil, and in some cases, say in the mortgage market, can take up to 2 years. And then on top of that, there is a substantial delay in repossession in many markets. In some, there is less of that, and we find tremendous development. For instance, in car finance, the instruments and the jurisprudence have been developed to allow for the sort of efficient workings that one would like to see, and the cost of car financing is extremely low. And this has been something very beneficial to the consumer, unlike, say, housing, where Brazilians have a hard time with housing finance in general. So the bankruptcy law, I believe, is also an area where we could do some revision. It isn't something we have on the table at the moment, but definitely something that we need to take up. Sure. On the transmission mechanism, we see it pretty much like, well, I suppose most central banks see it these days, which is multiple channels working in parallel. Credit being one, the exchange rate being another one, and all of it kind of flowing through an environment which has become very forward-looking. So there's the exchange rate, while we are a closed economy, does play a role also on expectations. So it's a pretty standard answer. The tricky part is how does it work in Brazil, not so much the channels. I think the channels are the same as you find everywhere. And that's what we're working on improving, is making sure those lines are clear. And once we push a button here, you feel it over there. We're more of a closed economy than most, so the exchange rate tends to play less of a role, but still it does play a role. We have been revising our pass-through estimates so that we can calibrate our policy better. We've done a cross-country study on this that is quite interesting. It's probably going to be published by one of our, actually an interesting situation. One of our board members had to leave, and we brought somebody in who was in academia, and these two co-authored this paper, the outgoing, the ingoing. This is the new board member in charge of research, and the one who left. And they've done a wonderful piece on this, looking at 20 years of monthly data in some 70 countries. We feel pretty comfortable on what we found there, even though this statistical series for us is awfully short. We've only been floating for a year and a half. Now, on real interest rates, we've come down from sort of the low 20s to where we are now. Some will probably call it 10. And we're still higher than most countries. But the trend, I believe, is a positive one. We of course know we have one instrument and one target, and that's not something we can control ourselves. We need the whole equation to work, including fiscal policy, banking policy, the balance of payments, etc. The whole thing has to work so as to produce lower real interest rates without threatening to take us back to an unstable environment. That has been the case, and I expect it to continue to be the case. If you scratch out our history, you can probably imagine an equilibrium with a lower rate, but scratching out history is not something one can do. You have to take the time to kind of, you know, retrace your steps and rebuild credibility. But we're a country now with a 3% of GDP primary surplus that's consolidated, including everything, states, social security, etc. We've gone through our banking crisis in the 90s, and we have a banking sector that looks quite healthy, well capitalized. The balance of payments is free of short-term capital other than trade finance, which is a big change. I have a view on that, very strong one, that's a sign of weakness that never fails to bring trouble, particularly when it comes with the managed exchange rate. We're free of that completely. So I expect that over time we will look more normal. It's just a matter of continuing. And indeed, this is showing, the path is clear. Now, what is also just as troublesome as that, if you allow me another 2 minutes, is the still quite high level of rates at the consumer level for all the reasons I've discussed here and others that I haven't mentioned. So we have a measure, sort of a weighted average measure of bank spreads in Brazil, and they're quite high, and it's not because there is monopoly power or anything like that. It's because there are a lot of wedges. One is this legal wedge that comes from the inability to collateralize loans that we're working on changing. Tax wedges are also there, so there's a fair amount of work to be done there. We started a project on cleaning up the environment there, let's call it, last October. It was almost a year old. When we started, this blended average credit spread was at 52%, to give you an idea. And now that has come down to the mid-30s, still very high. We're going down. We've made a full diagnosis of that. We've made 22 or 3 proposals to address the problem, some of which we have been able do something about. Some are slower, may require changing laws and the like. But we wanted to bring it to the attention of the public, to our friends in the press in Brazil. We do a monthly report on this. We've been doing it for a year now. Every month we go out, we say, okay, this is where the spreads are. And then we have a spreadsheet with these 20-odd measures saying, you know, this is what we have been able to achieve. Some of it is under our control, some of it isn't. Let's get going. So it's not enough to get the macro environment to work, although that'll go a long way. You know, we must also fix these micro things. And you can just imagine, this spread peaked in the high 60s. I mentioned here 52 when we started. This thing peaked at 68% 2.5 years ago. It's just not workable. I mean, you can plug in any old theory you want that doesn't add up. Anybody who wants to borrow that rate must be in looking at very difficult circumstances, or maybe high returns, I guess, on occasion, but not something that is normal. So the whole thing is moving in the right direction, and it's not just the point you mentioned. You have to add this extra dimension. I expect it'll be another year or two before we get down into real low levels. But this thing is you can understand it. There's sort of a cause and a cure, and it's up to us to kind of work on the cure at this point, and we're doing that as fast as we can.
In the middle.
20 years ago, 2 points I'm going to raise. The first one, 20 years ago, we had here in London in 1982 a conference on the debt problem. And that debt problem was actually meaningful as a crisis, because since then I've heard the word crisis time and time again, and it's no crisis anymore. Now, in that conference, there were two governors from the Central Bank of Brazil, Governor Lira, who was in the conference lamenting the fact that you were then abandoning a growth-oriented policy, which he called successful for previous years. The other governor was Governor Langoni, who had just resigned his governorship. He was lamenting the fact that they were kind of an open sea and possibly been forced by all these international creditors to move into what we would call financial prudence. Now, can I deduce the following from your talk? That really you have, first of all, not mentioned growth, which possibly is a good thing, consistently throughout your speech. Second, when it comes to financial prudence, you have moved into that. May I ask, is there some one index which shows some consistency in your performance since 1982 to year 2000? That's the first question. The second has to do with the word governance, which you came to at the end of your speech, which has become a kind of chewing gum or sweet for children in the sweet shop today. I would say that there is a lot to be said, enormous amount to be said about corporate governance. But there are extremes today. There's a conference here in Tennessee in a week or 2 or 3 weeks' time, which is called Global Governance. Whereas I understand one, I am afraid I cannot understand the other, the global. And my question is, for a central bank, which is in the thick of it, what kind of governance are you concerned with? Are you concerned with governance as a central bank governor, or whose governance are you talking about?
Okay.
Your banks?
Let me start with the last question and get back to the first one. That last one is a quicker answer. There's a very good questions that give me a chance to say a couple words more. The governance I mentioned is corporate governance, and I mentioned the corporation law, accounting standards, so I thought I was pretty clear on that. In a way, I think the other level of governance that is required for a democratic society is proper governance at the government level, whereby the citizens of the country understand what it is that the government is doing, where the money is going, why, and so on, which I find requires a stable macro environment, or else you have no idea. And we know that from our experience with inflation in Brazil. So I was referring to corporate governance, but the fiscal responsibility law, in a way, is a governance law for the government. Now, global governance, I'm not sure what that means. I think the world may have to deal with this recent meeting now in Prague. I just came from that, talked about global public goods and things like that. But as far as I understand it, there's governance at a company level, which I find to be extremely healthy. There's governance at the government level, and that is part and parcel of a democratic society. That's the only way I find one can run a country. And I think one kind of reinforces the other. And I would stop there. The global thing is more complicated. I guess countries get together, but they are accountable. I think the word governance comes with accountability. And they're accountable to those, to their citizens, in the case of a country, who voted and who elected their representatives, and to their shareholders, if you're a business. Now, the other issue you alluded to, the two former governors of the central bank, is a fascinating one, and it would probably require another talk to expand on it and to do justice to it. But there's one point I can't not do here, not put out here just for discussion, which is the following. I believe that was a moment where the model we had that had served us so well sort of hit a wall. It was a model of a closed economy with a lot of protection, a large government, subsidies, a government that was trying to do everything, and a model that, you know, had a useful life but ran its course and hit a wall. And as it always seems to be the case when you're most vulnerable, something happens. That was the case with Brazil in the early 80s with the foreign debt and oil and interest rates and so on, dealing a crippling blow to us. Now, that really coincided with a change in the political regime. And that's no coincidence either. We had military rule and a strong government system in place, large and strong government. The economics ran into trouble, and that quickly led to the end of the military regime. And in my view, a lot of what we've seen since then has been a transition into a new system where you have a smaller, more focused government, and one that does the things that, well, our government is doing: education, health, public goods like monetary stability, and so on. A more open economy, more productive. This same model was still in place during the 80s when we showed negative 1% total factor productivity growth. It basically hit a wall, but because it had done so well before, it made it extremely hard for change to take place. Now, I see absolutely no conflict between stability, which is a necessary ingredient, and growth and development. In fact, I think one is a necessary condition for the other. This is a debate that every now and then pops up in on the screen in Brazil. I think we're coming to a conclusion that one doesn't preclude the other. For instance, we need higher savings. And if you don't have a stable environment, you don't save. And it's a miracle that our savings rate in Brazil stayed in the high teens during the 80s and early 90s. I think we need to save more, and I think we're designing financial and capital markets and monetary institutions so that people will save more, so that we can invest more. We're working on a more efficient capital market so that the investment yields a higher return. We're investing in education, of course. I think that always goes first. But I left the growth topic in the background, but I started with something that really is the essence, which is productivity. This is either hard work or productivity that's going to lead you to faster growth. And the productivity side, to me, is extremely promising in Brazil right now. We have been investing in education heavily for the last 6 years. We have a very we have a lot of upside on the things that I mentioned and discussed here today, lowering the cost of capital in Brazil, which I believe are worth a point of GDP growth. There is enough, I think, on the new economy side in Brazil also to make me optimistic. We have a free-for-all in the infrastructure needed for this new economy. And I don't think this is a complete miracle, but it certainly can't hurt if you have that. So there's a lot of that in place in Brazil. And I think we're finally going to break away from that debate that took us out for such a long time. Anyway, I'm very hopeful, but feel, you know, we need to keep the momentum going. We're far from being in a position where one can claim this is a virtuous circle already, although the potential is there.
Okay, two more quick questions. First you, and then you, and that will be it.
There aren't a whole lot of successful multinational firms based in Brazil, even with the integration of the Taco Bell. Is there a feeling that you have to get your own house in order before you can expand beyond your borders? Or are there other things, for example, the tax code that might be discouraging firms?
Very, very good question. I can give you a short answer, I feel like going on for a long time. I'll give you a couple of things. First, there's a bit of a paradox now in the face of it. When you look at the volume of foreign direct investment we're getting, sorry, close to $30 billion a year, and the volume of portfolio investment we're getting, which is close to zero. Now, FDI comes in with control, and it tells you something about governance, about fear. And local businesses face an extremely high cost of capital, and one way to fix it is by developing the markets the way I mentioned. That's one answer I think we need to address, and we are addressing, and I think there's nothing magical about that. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're going to just put the plain vanilla things in place. I believe that'll help. The other is this degree of openness. If you're in a closed economy, in a protected environment, it is highly likely that you're not going to be globally competitive. Typically, you won't have access to the inputs, the capital goods, the technology, even the culture that you need to be at the cutting edge. That is changing in Brazil. There's more to do. But I think if you want to export, you need to open up, which is very counterintuitive to many. If you want to be competitive, you need to do the same. We do have a few companies that are expanding, and I think our entrepreneurial culture is very strong. You have a lot of Brazilians who are trained in business conditions in Brazil, which were extremely complex and, let's call them, exciting for a number of years. Have a lot of people with that background running or in very high-level positions in many global firms. So I think there's nothing wrong with intrinsically with Brazil or its people. It's just the regulatory macro environment that needs to be fixed so that more of this can take place along the lines you mentioned in your question.
Final question.
From your central banker's perspective, what do you see as the key domestic and external risks to your virtuous circle scenario?
Main risks I always find are domestic. Maybe that's what I'm paid to do. Are you switching me into my non-academic hat, I suppose. I won't take too long, although it's always tempting. But I think the key risk is that we don't stay the course for some reason. Now, we do have the tools now to do that, but you never know. I'm confident that we will stay on track. That's one risk. External risks are all over the newspapers these days. Oil being perhaps the top one. Some kind of a financial crisis could be another. I put those there as well, but second to ourselves. I'm not pessimistic, but that's how I see it. In fact, I would say that the distribution of risk has changed. And the middle of our distribution now has growth and stability as the most likely scenario, unlike what it was 10, 15 years ago. But if you think of it straight, there's always risk. But it's symmetric, though. You know, it could be there's a risk. It'll be a lot better than this basic scenario. Also, anyway.
Before we then turn to Armenia and Praga in the traditional way, just a couple of housekeeping remarks. First, you're all cordially invited to a reception in the senior common room dining room on the fifth floor immediately after this. And second, for all those who don't understand what global governance is about, you can, of course, learn by coming to the LSE conference on the subject in a couple of weeks' time. Armenia, thank you very much indeed for a wide-ranging, excellent tour de force about the future of Brazil, and may your virtuous circle go on for a very, very long time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.